And hello again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another edition of the Gridiron Graduates. I'm your host, Bill Rossetti, and not joining me, at least right now, is my buddy Ian Wharton. Ian has other plans going on right now, so he unfortunately can't make it. Hopefully he'll be in later, but if not, I'll be flying solo as far as the two of us go. But not completely flying solo, because got another great guest and very excited to have him on today. He is the director of the Scouting Academy. He is a former scout in the NFL with the Philadelphia Eagles, the New York Giants, and the New York Jets. My good friend, Mr. Dan Hatman, on the show tonight. Dan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I can only hope Ian is involved in the Clippers hostage situation right now. That's my only hope.
Yeah, that story's coming out of nowhere, and it's certainly surprising. I mean, that's the fun thing about this wide window that we have of between teams beginning to negotiate contracts and when players can actually sign them. All the talk was like, oh, he's going to go to Dallas, and yay for him. Now all of a sudden, hey, the Clippers are basically holding him hostage, trying to get him to stay. So should be interesting as we reach that midnight deadline.
Absolutely.
So figured get Dan on here and just kind of talk a little bit about himself, you know, what it's like being a scout or whatever, and then Ian and I had some questions for him, and we'll kind of talk about that. So first thing I want to talk to you, Dan, is, if you don't mind, just kind of give us a little insight on what it's like being a scout, you know, maybe a little insight on your career. Like I said, you've scouted for three different teams, and you worked under Andy Reid, so just a little bit of insight, whatever you can share with us.
Sure. The business is fantastic when you're actually doing the work of player evaluation, helping build a roster. It's enjoyable. It's something that, you know, everybody dreams about, being able to go to an office every day and to watch football and have an impact on what happens on Sundays. So that part was always worthwhile. You know, like you mentioned, I had that opportunity with a couple different clubs. So they each present their own unique setups, their own unique culture, the situation, what have you, surrounding how they want to attack the process, which was, you know, very interesting for me to be able to see that in a variety of different situations. You do have some people that come through the business and fall into one of those situations where they start as an intern with the team and they end up spending 20 years there. And it's not to knock that by any stretch of the imagination, but there is a certain perspective gained by moving around through a few different teams and seeing pros and cons to different parts of the process. So I've always looked upon that favorably in terms of, you know, how that was been able to treat me in my career. You know, the part that people, you know, kind of glamorize is just the actual day-to-day life. It's, you know, we talk about long hours, you talk about the grind. I think people, you know, kind of conceptualize that and they feel like they have a grasp on it. It's different when you are watching your 115th practice squad type player and it's September, and you're trying to figure out which five or six guys you think you might want to add to your practice squad that are on the list, and you've been in since 5 o'clock in the morning and it's 10 o'clock at night and you can't see straight, but you got to get these things banged out. And it's not to complain about the life, it's just to, I usually try to tell people that it's not always a great time. There are some elements to it, you know, especially as it pertains to compensation. A lot of people seem to think that because the players and the coaches and the owners are making their money, that the scouts are as well. Certainly not the case. First few jobs in the league, I was making less than $20,000 with no benefits to live in a major city. It's one of those things where you have to be in a situation where you can, you know, live well within your means and kind of stretch your dollar for a few years there in hopes that you can stick. And then when you look around at your peers, you know, I was just reading a story today in Monday Morning Quarterback about a scout, Joe Bomarito, that I worked with the Jets, that was let go when Idzik came on board. And Joe's a great guy, and he's obviously landed on his feet and things are going well for him. But, you know, the way he paints the picture is just, you know, John came in and wanted to go in a different direction. And it had, you know, no obvious bearing to Joe as it pertained to his ability to evaluate players, but simply that general manager wanted to go in a separate direction. And then a year later, Idzik is relieved of his duties, and another general manager comes in and cleans out the entire scouting staff, pretty much top to bottom. And now all those guys again, who had just gotten into place, just moved, what have you, are bouncing to their third city in as many years and trying to get stabilized. And so, not like I said, to paint the job as negative, but simply the life around it. There's no real stability. There's no real security. And you're doing it because you love it, and so is everybody else, and you're just hoping the chips fall into place in the right way for you.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a grind talking with you and other people have been in the business, and really good info. You know, glad you were able to share all of that. I want to get now to some of the questions that Ian and I came up with for you to talk about on the show. The first one we're going to ask you, from a cultural perspective, how hard do you think it is for first-time head coaches as opposed to rehires to change the locker room?
Well, I think it could be easier for a first-time head coach to change a culture than a rehire in certain situations. I think the situation where a rehire can be really effective is if they had tremendous success somewhere else and that brand is carrying over. So I think about Jeff Fisher, who, you know, has a, I believe, close to 15-year track or history with the Houston / Tennessee Titans franchise, and, you know, gets relieved of his duties, just, you know, partially due to the time invested and where the organization wanted to move. And now he's in St. Louis and he's able to install what he's looking for there. And I'm assuming, you know, without having a lot of insight into that locker room, people are buying into his credibility because of the brand associated with his name. Whereas my guess is Eric Mangini did not have a similar situation in Cleveland when he was trying to get that franchise moving in the right direction after coming off of a less than successful Jets campaign. His brand did not come with that positive connotation. So when you look at a brand new coach who's coming in, and I, you know, I was able to be a part of that situation in both the Jets when Rex Ryan was hired and in Philadelphia when Chip Kelly was hired. And in both situations, the enthusiasm that everybody had about the new vision, the new path, the new direction, it was incredibly positive. And you had a lot of people excited to move in a way that they felt was going to be better for their careers and was going to be better for where they wanted to head. And their personal, the team, professionally, what have you. And so those brand new coaches were able to grab a quick foothold off of something that came from a situation of being blank. You know, these guys come in, they've yet to run a team. So everything they say, people want to take as truth because there's nothing to either prove or disprove it. So a lot of people just take it on its face and move forward. And so you can see a situation where a new coach can have an easier time changing culture.
Mm-hmm. And just as a kind of a side question, looking at some of the new coaches entering this season, like Jim Tom Sula and others, are there any that you're excited about as far as watching them become a head coach for the first time, or, you know, what they could do with some of their new teams?
I'm certainly biased, but I have a strong affinity for Todd Bowles, and I'm very excited to see him run a ball club. His process, his demeanor, his football knowledge, his leadership skills, the things that he presented in Philadelphia in an otherwise very difficult situation were nothing short that's less than stellar. And so I was not surprised by his success in Arizona, and expect nothing but success out of him in New York. But I guess that brings me to one thing with the coaching piece I did want to talk about. And that is, you know, see a Jim Tom Sula, and my mind also goes to someone like a John Harbaugh. You know, when you're talking about a head coach and what it takes to be successful there, we typically end up hiring from the coordinator ranks to fill that role. And it's always been interesting to me that we don't look beyond that and don't look to find other position coaches. Now, I know a lot of people on the outside just don't have the experience or the knowledge about who some of these position coaches are, what they bring to the table. But when you talk about a front office perspective, a lot of that information is more readily available. And the skill set it takes to be a position coach is different than the skill set it takes to be a coordinator, which is different than the skill set it takes to be a head coach. And certain individuals have been able to display all of that. You know, they have all those skills, and that's fantastic. And if you can find one of those, you know, grab on them with both hands and don't let go. But there are plenty of coaches out there that have head coaching type skill sets that just are not good coordinators. And it might be something as simple as their ability to make in-game adjustments and call the right plays and in the right situations is just not at an elite level. Whereas their ability to lead an organization, prepare practice plans, prepare overall concepts, to coach the coaches and get everybody ready to spend a week on what it's going to take to beat their opponent, they're much better in that area. And so it's always been interesting to me to see how much excitement we get when it comes to coaching hires, to look at, oh, well, their unit just had this or that. And I kind of stop and say, well, calling plays and being successful offensively or defensively does not correlate with being a strong head coach. And we've seen a variety of head coaches. You know, a Norv Turner comes to mind, who's had an unbelievable track record of calling plays and being a coordinator at the offensive side of the ball, but has yet to really tie it all together from a head coaching perspective and be as successful in that arena.
Yeah, that was the name I was thinking too as you were talking about that. Norv Turner certainly at the top of the list of guys that outstanding coordinators, and we're seeing it now in Minnesota, but had a so-so career as a head coach in San Diego. I want to go back now, talk a little bit about scouting. We've obviously all gotten into this business because we grew up as fans of the game, you know, cheering for our favorite teams. But as we get into wanting to do this as a career, either, you know, radio, writing, scouting, whatever, we have to learn to put that subjectivity out, like our, you know, the fanalist inside us, I guess we could say, put that to the side and be more objective and be like an actual analyst. Talk about some of the things you did as you went through going into your career and as you've gone through your career to get yourself more objective and try to remove not necessarily all the bias, because some of us are still going to have a little bit of bias. That's just the human nature, but as much bias as possible that you've been able to get rid of.
Sure. I think one of the big things that helped me kind of wrap my head around the best way to approach this was the concept of really creating tiers, creating strata for players, and understanding that at the top of every position group, you're going to have a few players that everybody can agree are elite, that could play in any system, that should be dominant no matter what happens. So, you know, the names Aaron Rodgers, J.J. Watt, Calvin Johnson, Adrian Peterson, what have you, over the last few years will come to mind. And no matter what scheme you wanted to run, what team setting, you know, weather, what have you, you would expect those players to be dominant in all those areas. Then there's everybody else, and they fall into a variety of different categories, but the vast majority of their value stems from how they're going to be used. And I usually call them kind of scheme dependent to a point. And that was something that took me a little while to kind of wrap my head around. Cause as you mentioned, you go into this and it's, you know, to kind of steal from baseball, you would assume that a third baseman is a third baseman is a third baseman. So therefore a wide receiver is a wide receiver is a wide receiver. So we should be able to rank them all between 1 and 100. And this is the best guy, and this is the second best guy, and so forth and so on. And someone I worked with in Philadelphia, and a really bright mind in both football and out, a guy by the name of Alan Dandar, really pushed a concept onto me when you think about ratings versus rankings. And so he despised rankings, the idea of listing, you know, a group of people between 1 and 25 or 1 and 50 or whatever, and saying this guy is better than this guy, who's better than this guy, because what that ignores is the actual difference between those players and why those differences are there. Mm-hmm. The difference between 1 and 2 might be drastically higher quantitatively than 2 and 3, But when you just see 1, 2, 3, your mind goes to a very simple linear kind of progression where 1 is just going to be slightly better than 2, who's just slightly better than 3. And so it doesn't display the clustering, the natural dispersion of players across a bell curve that happens because human beings, being what they are going to be inherently different. The second thing that rankings ignore is the fact that once you move past a few players at the top of a position group who are, you know, independent of scheme and are going to be dominant at all levels, everybody else is based on which flavor of ice cream you like. And they should be subcategorized. And if you really like to have short, shifty slot receivers, then there's a whole bunch of guys that you might like in that vein. Whereas if someone else wants a larger frame to attack the middle of the field, I think about Chip Kelly using Jordan Matthews or New Orleans and Sean Payton using Marcus Colston or what have you. If you like a different body type to attack the same part of the field, you might have an entirely different ranking of those players based on how you want to use them. So for me, the things that I had to kind of realize is that when you're stepping into scouting, unless you're the final decision maker, unless you're the general manager, it no longer matters what the hell you think. You're not working for you. You're not picking the players. You're not determining who's going to be on the roster. What you're doing is you're presenting information to the decision maker such that that individual, in conjunction with the coaches and the other people at the top of the organization, can pick the best fits. So I had to start learning less about what I would want to see on the field and more about what my head coach or my GM wanted to see on the field. And one of my big examples of that, you know, kind of hit me over the head was in Philly. I believe it was a 2013 draft. I had running backs for college cross-check. So I'm a pro scout by trade, meaning I focus on advanced scouting of opponents. I focus on free agency, studying every player that's no longer got college eligibility, studying other leagues, CFL, AFL. That was where I spent most of my time. So college, all your pro scouts come in and do cross-check in the springtime. So after the combine, I was provided a list of all the running backs we felt were draft eligible. I think they ended up being 27 names or something like that. And my job is to come in as a clear set of eyes and to stack the board at that position based on how I see them. And one of the first things I did was ask about what we wanted at the running back position moving into the next year. And it was given fairly generic, you know, just go find me the best running back from the scouting department. So I shifted over and went to Deuce Staley, the running backs coach, and said, Deuce, you know, what are we looking for? And he explained in so much clarity and detail about the nuances that they wanted, how they wanted a guy to read certain blocks, how they wanted a guy to affect the passing game, what have you. And so now I'm going in, and this is the Monty Ball. This is Eddie Lacy, Le'Veon Bell, what have you. And if I was picking for me, I really like the Eddie Lacy, the Le'Veon Bells in terms of how they attack the ball. I'm a big inside zone fan. I don't necessarily need my backs to be excellent in the passing game. But that's if Dan Hatman's the general manager. But I wasn't. I wasn't making the final decision. So in listening to the coaching staff and what they wanted, I had guys like Andre Ellington and Gio Bernard much higher on my board than other people did. And I deflated Monty Ball and I deflated Jonathan Franklin and a bunch of other guys that went in the mid rounds, or in Monty Ball's case, even higher, because they didn't provide what our coaching staff was looking for. And the scouting side of the building was upset with my rankings. I got a lot of flack for it because I wasn't fitting into the mold of what everybody else in the scouting community had seen that year. Everybody loved Monty Ball. And I kept seeing a guy that was good at a lot of things, great at nothing, and brought none of the special traits in certain areas that our coaching staff wanted. And so I kept pushing down his value in terms of that. I evaluated his traits and pushed down his value. And like I said, I got a lot of flack for it. But at the end of the day, got a lot of praise from the coaching staff in terms of looking at that player and saying, yeah, that's a guy that we could really use and we'll be excited about having on our roster. And again, to come back to your point, to kind of drop what you would want in terms of those players, those traits, you know, I would want Eddie Lacy, but that might not have been the best fit for our team. I've got to drop my ego at the door and realize I'm not making the final decision. I just have to simply tell my bosses, hey, this is what I saw from these players.
I want to hit on a point you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier and kind of talk about ranking players and just kind of stacking them all up against each other. I do like what we're seeing lately, you know, from draft Twitter and draft analysts, whatnot, making more of an effort to separate players within the position. Like you talked about wide receivers, separating your, you know, 6'5 X type receivers from your 5'11 slot type receivers, you know, not just ranking, say, and just to throw names, Calvin Johnson 1 and Wes Welker 2, you know, separating them into their own categories or on the defensive side of the ball, like 4-3 edge rushers, 3-4 edge rushers, whatnot. So it's interesting to see how we're making a move to kind of help people understand that, you know, like you said, a wide receiver is not just that. He could move around. He could play different positions. You know, a tight end could slot out at times. So it's a lot more intricate than, you know, many years ago. You mentioned, too, when you kind of jotted your thoughts down, you talked about Louis Riddick. Just talk a little bit about how he has helped you as well and you know, whatever, and anything else you want to talk about him?
Sure. Guy just absolutely changed how I attack the process and what the process could and should be. You know, absolutely the brightest football mind from a front office standpoint I've ever been around in terms of how he expected the process to be tackled, what he did to achieve goals. Because it wasn't just like a lot of other teams do, which is, hey, here's the objective. We hired you, so go figure it out. It was, hey, here's the objective. I'm going to demand more of you than you could have ever imagined. But at the same time, here are all the tools you're going to need to do that job. And here's how we want it done. And this is why it's important. And really taught. He was an excellent teacher. And so the big things he put across to me was the value of context. I talk about it just over and over again as much as I possibly can.
Very meaning... key as you two have talked about.
What's that?
Very key as you two have talked about throughout Twitter and anything
like
that.
Oh, my Lord. There's just so much that needs to be understood. I mean, I asked a question tonight on Twitter. I was just interested to see what the responses would be about analytics and the quantitative side of it. And it was not to bash the quantitative side of it, but what I'm noticing lately is that the quantitative side is actually flipped this thing 180 degrees. And now instead of being the group that was disrespected, they're now the group that's disrespecting the qualitative side. And they keep talking about, you know, how they can study these numbers and predict what's going to happen. And I asked a simple question, what number is out there that's ever predicted performance on its own without needing some kind of context, without needing someone who understood what the player was being asked to do to a point to come in and study that situation. And so they were talking about, let's say, running backs, and yards per touch came up. And so someone brought that point up and I asked, okay, that's fine. Yards per touch, I get it. It can definitely help illuminate certain things, but yards per touch, if it doesn't include some information regarding the blocking, the actual run play that was designed, how well they executed it, were the wide receiver involved, what was the down and distance, did the defense expect the run, did they expect the pass, were they keyed up against it, are you winning, are you losing, because again, defenders can change their perspective based on that information, what was the weather, what's the part of the season. You know, I can just list off 25 different things that could have all impacted how well a runner on a touch is able to gain yards that might have nothing to do with the runner's actual ability to gain yards, but how every other puzzle piece needs to come together in order for that individual to maximize the run. And so that was really what Riddick helped instill upon me before we'd ever watch a play. Before we ever actually watched the ball get snapped, I was expected to relay about 10 pieces of information to him. So we'd sit there and go to watch a player. And before the ball would actually leave the ground, I'd be expected to relay to him down in distance, score, you know, basic formation, basic defensive alignment. What were the safeties and linebackers telling the offense? Is there anything you can learn from the split of the wide receivers? what have you, so that you can understand what was about to happen from that snapshot. And then that information, as you continue to gain context during the course of the play, and then there's obviously context that comes, you know, outside of what you can actually see on film about the player's mental status, their injuries, the coaching, the play calls, what's going on in the locker room, what's going on in the meeting room. There's so much other information that can come into play here. If you don't actively pursue that information to the best of your ability, understanding that especially as an outside evaluator, you're never going to get all of it. But if you don't pursue as much of that as possible, you're never going to get quality, consistent, accurate evaluations out. You're always going to miss on certain areas because you didn't dig to that extra layer. So that's a big thing for me and how I want to evaluate is I'm going to learn about a trait or watch a player, and I want to dig, you know, like you're peeling an onion, a few more layers down to make, you know, more insightful understanding of what I just saw.
And luckily for us as, you know, evaluators and watching the game, a lot of this stuff has become more readily available. You can go to different websites and look up a player's injury history or stats and anything like that. And you brought up a good point too, like you mentioned context. It's just amazing how, you know, there's so much information out there that we have to know. Like, there's definitely people that will try to sit and watch film and just try to watch the player and just think, oh, well, he did this well, and, you know, this is the type of back he is. But they might not understand, you know, even just on-field stuff. Like, what were some of his teammates doing? Like, the linemen or the receivers, like you mentioned. And then some of the off-the-field stuff, like time of game, field position, score, stuff like that. So a lot of info out there to really take in. And, you know, I'm really glad you brought up the idea of context and talked about Lewis, because Lewis certainly is obviously very insightful. He does great work on ESPN and, you know, helps you out with the Scouting Academy. So we can certainly see why you chose him to help you run the Scouting Academy.
Yeah, just absolutely fantastic to have him around. ESPN should give him a much bigger platform to communicate if at all possible.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back now to another one of these questions we had for you, and we'll kind of stick with the scouting topic here. Ian asked you, how challenging is it to be scouting for ideals that you don't necessarily prioritize, and how can you overcome that?
Absolutely difficult to be valuing highly things that you don't personally value highly. I think where you can overcome that is with something I refer to as trait-based evaluation. So when you set out to watch a player under current parameters that most NFL teams are using, when you get done watching the player, you put a final grade on that individual. More often than not, when you're relating it to college scouting, it's going to be a round grade. And that round grade is supposed to be predictive of all that player's future performance based on what you saw and learned about the player, whether it be film, background checks, what have you, combine numbers. And the real root of the problem is that requires you as the evaluator to take all the traits that you just saw on film, all the numbers you saw, all the, you know, interview material you were able to gather, and weigh it all together inside your head, and for you to come up with a grade. And if you don't value a trait that your bosses value, it's really hard for me to believe that you can be completely objective and still rate that player where your boss would want them rated. And for you to not instill a little bit of your opinion, let's say you're on the fence with a guy, the grade has to be between a second round grade and a third round grade. Let's just say that's all you got. And you're on the fence with a guy. You want to call him a 2.5, but your boss won't let you. It's either a 2 or a 3. You pick one. Well, if you don't like the traits, you're going to call him a 3. Because you don't like the traits. And it's a cover your ass grade. You know, I remember hearing scouts before meetings with players that they were, you know, a little bit ambiguous over and didn't know what to do with. really hover around a fourth round grade. It's in the middle of a 1 through 7 grading scale, first round to seventh round. And would hear scouts say things like, well, I put a fourth on him. You know, I figure if he turns out to be all right, well, we had a fourth round grade on him. And if he doesn't turn out to be very good, well, we only had a fourth round grade on him. And so there's a whole justification measure there where just cover your own ass. And so when I shifted things, and I recommend shifting things to trade-based evaluation, now you grade the traits. And it doesn't matter if you like the trait or not. You grade the trait. If you're watching a wide receiver and you're watching his route running, you're watching his separation quickness and his hands and his body control and his adjust, even if you don't necessarily want to use your receivers in a certain way, it's much more objective. You're just grading the traits that the player brings to the table, and it allows the decision maker who actually has to make a call on the player to look at those trait grades and determine how that profile comes together and how valuable that profile is to the organization. And so if you want to, like I said, very quickly get away from your own internal bias, stop putting one end-all be-all grade, especially a round grade, which has zero bearing on future performance, and just grade the traits that the player presents, and you'll be amazed at the increase in your effectiveness, your accuracy, your efficiency moving forward, and your ability to have a nuanced conversation. So if someone comes to you and says, I don't agree with this player being the third guy in your board or whatever the heck that means, you can ask them, okay, well, what traits do you value? Look at your board and say, okay, well, this is the player that would work for your system, or this is the player that would work for your system. Again, remembering there's only a few guys top of any position group that are scheme independent, that can be dominant wherever. Very, very few of them. So everybody else has pluses and minuses. You just have to understand which pluses you have to have and which minuses you can live with. And if you can grade by traits, you can get there.
And that was kind of what I wanted to ask you, and you definitely hit on it, how we're trying to get away from using round grades, like get away from saying this guy's a first round guy or this guy's a, you know, early second, mid second, and moving towards actually projecting what he can be, you know, future starter, backup, things like that.
Yeah, I think it speaks to a whole different level. And then, you know, especially with your mid round to late round guys, where it's just what flavor do you like? Do you like vanilla? Do you like chocolate? Do you like strawberry? You know, you can be much more clear about where you think this guy is. You know, the kid that's in the supplemental draft right now, the tackle from Clemson,
Isaiah Battle. You know,
there's a huge like discrepancy over him in terms of, well, he provides this size and athletic profile. Well, so do a lot of guys. And a lot of them have failed in the NFL. Size and athletic ability has no direct correlation with success. Mm-hmm. If you have it, you can actually enter the NFL. And I guess that might be the correlation, that if you don't have those two things, you're never going to get, you know, signed, drafted, what have you, and therefore will never be on a field. But, I mean, how many guys can we point to that have had that profile and have bombed? So my thing is, as I watched that individual, I saw a guy that, yes, provides an athletic profile that you like and certainly has a size profile from a length and frame that you like, but a lot of his technique, a lot of his functional strength, a lot of his consistency, his mental processing, a lot of the things that actually allow him to be a good tackle in the league are not there. So what I see is a guy that, in my opinion, unless he has a phenomenal offensive line coach and strength program, which not every team provides. Not all 32 teams provide the same level of development. I think that's another mistake in the evaluation community, is assuming, oh, once he gets to the NFL, he'll finally get coached and he'll finally get to a strength program. A lot of these colleges have better coaches, and, or I shouldn't say it that way, have quality coaches and quality strength programs. And so the guy could have been in that same program for 3-4 years now. And if he's not making gains, I mean, you don't think Clemson's investing in top coaches and top strength and conditioning departments? So what's happening? Either the kid's not taking it or he's unable to take it. That doesn't bode well for him. So I see a kid that has, you know, 2 at the minimum years before he's ready to even come close to starter, maybe 3 or more. Well, what's a guy that's 3 years away from being a starter and a developmental guy worth to you? You know, to me, that's a 6th round pick at best. Mm-hmm. And if he's got character off field issues, I mean, now we're talking, I can't touch him before maybe the seventh. If I touch him at all, what's the point? What am I getting out of a guy that might not be ready in 3 years? My coach might not have a job in 3 years. So the guy that I'm trusting to develop this player and make him a quality NFL performer might not be on my staff if I have to dump my coaches because they're not getting performance. We only have 46 guys on game day. I don't know where we stash all these developmental guys, but they don't have roster spots anymore.
Mm-hmm. And tomorrow is the supplemental draft. So with what you're talking, it sounds like you would advise against a team using one of their supplemental picks this year to take a guy like Battle, you know, maybe wait and see if he could pick him up as a free agent.
Depends on where we're at in our program build. You know, okay. if I have seven offensive linemen that I can bring in on my 46, which is about what you take on your 46 man roster in a game day. If I have my seven already and Battle's and, you know, could be somewhere between my eighth and 10th guy, you know, to most teams keep around 10 on the 53 or at least keep one on the practice squad. If he's in that mix, right, based on where my roster is at, and if I do believe that I have a coach that can provide more than what he was getting in college or the scheme, or if there's something about that I thought we can get more out of. And again, you know, I feel confident that we have a strength and conditioning program that can increase this player's functional strength and mobility. He just has some muscle groups in his core and lower that are not fully developed, and you can see it in his posture and his ability to execute certain assignments. He's just not there yet. If I felt like we could do those things, then yeah, you could absolutely take a shot on developing him. But if I'm one of those teams that like needs an offensive lineman, you know, I've got three guys, maybe four, maybe barely five or something like that. I'm expecting this guy to come in year one and be active on my 46th, be my swing tackle, be my seventh offensive lineman. I don't see it.
Okay. So he's more of like a depth guy, depth developmental guy for you instead of a kind of
thing. Yeah, and that assumes, you know, that the character stuff is all on the up and up, which right. I haven't gotten any, you know, accurate feedback on in terms of where he's actually at. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff that you read is overstated and some of it's understated.
Right.
So, I mean, if he's a bad guy, then I'm not taking a chance at all. And I'm just done with it. And I'll wipe my hands of it. And if someone else gets him to be a starter for a year or two in the league, you know, that's fine. I'll save my fourth round pick and I'll try to take somebody else next year.
Right. Just looking through some of the other questions we have, it's nice that we've kind of tied them all in. You know, we asked you, like, what principle do you fall back on? And you've already talked about trait-based evaluation. I don't know if you want to expand a little bit more on that.
Well, I think the area where you can expand on it is the number of traits you want to look at. You know, what I do with, you know, our students when we first get started is we kind of boil it down to 10 general categories. And, you know, we're talking things like play speed, play strength, mental processing, athletic ability. And, you know, we can look at those and understand that there are subcategories to that. So athletic ability is going to break down into quickness, into agility, into balance, into explosive movements. Mental processing breaks down in a few areas in terms of pre-snap and post-snap reads. Can they take information from the classroom to the field? So you kind of need to figure out where you're at in terms of your football acumen, in terms of how many traits you can really evaluate accurately. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's better to start with the broader categories first and kind of get your feet underneath you and then really start digging inside of those and seeing how far you can go. I mean, I know of teams that when they look at players can get up to 50 to 60 different things that they could look at. Mental, physical, position specific, some of your quantitative combine metrics, height, weight, speed measurables. And you can get that far up. And then and some people bring it down to, like I said, a core 15, 20 things. Let's just look at the film, trust it, and move forward. But I think when we're talking about someone who wants to get into the evaluation space, I think you need to be honest with yourself in terms of where you're at football acumen wise. Realize there's a million resources out there for free in terms of content. Just looking to share it. gravitate to that, buy books, go to clinics, you know, dig into all that stuff as best you can, realize that you never know enough. I never sit here and tell myself that I've got all the answers. I'll tell you what I know now. I'll tell you what I don't. When I don't know something, I'm damn sure going to find someone in my network to try to help me fill in those gaps. And just to try to tack the process that way.
Couple more questions, and you've been great so far, Dan. And again, if you're for those listening, again, we're on with Dan Hatman, and if you're listening this far, you should know by now who Dan is. So, I asked you who have been some of your favorite players to scout in your career, and you listed a bunch of names. I'm just going to pick a couple that we could talk about. Trent Cole, you know. Was obviously an outstanding player for the Eagles. Now he's with the Colts. What did you see in Cole that, you know, that made him one of your favorites to watch?
Trent embodied a competitive toughness, a term I'm really drawn to, that I wish I saw out of other pass rushers. And I don't know if it relates to the fact that he's an avid hunter, and that is something that he just enjoys in his spare time. But he has a unique demeanor to him when it comes time to work that just it was almost attractive to be around. When he went to go out there to practice, go out there for games, what have you, if he put on the colors, if he put on the pads, he was coming for you. And, you know, this is a fourth round pick from Cincinnati, you know, was not a glamour draft pick by any stretch, you know, probably slightly undersized from a frame perspective as it pertained to a traditional overfront defensive end or a 4-3 defensive end. But he won. He won at the point of attack. He won because he knew how to set up his opponents. He was smart. He set up his moves. He attacked the things the right way. And, you know, he just had a long, productive career for a guy that, you know, no one would have called that when he was coming out of Cincinnati. And so it was just really a lot of fun to be around. I think that's probably the thing that I get a little spoiled with, is I actually had a chance to be around him and to see him take different coaching and the way he adapted to it. You'd be amazed at what different coaching in the NFL does to different players. In fact, the same team, Brandon Graham, admitted that being around Jim Washburn in Philly almost brought him to the point of quitting because he did not connect with that human being coaching him. And it drastically decreased his desire to be effective and to go out and bust his butt to get there. Whereas Trent, you know, had probably, I think maybe 5 different defensive line coaches in his last 7 years in Philly. And that's a lot. That's a lot of change in terms of what happens on a weekly basis to prepare that player, and was still able to go out and be effective every Sunday as if nothing had changed.
And I'm sure Eagles fans kind of cringed hearing the name Jim Washburn, because we all know when they ran that wide nine, how tough it was to watch. Because, I mean, the problem was, and you obviously know this, they didn't have the inside linebackers to really fit that system. Am I right saying that? Would you agree with that?
That was an issue for us, absolutely.
Yeah. Another player I want to talk about, as I'm just looking at Twitter, apparently J.J. Watt. Oh, no, it's too early. Maybe that was just someone. Because we're recording this during the top 100
oh, fair
players,
enough.
Players list. Not that that list really means anything. It's a whole lot of hoopla. You know, first off, they listed DeMarco Murray as the top running back. Now, nothing, I'm not taking anything away from DeMarco Murray, but obviously this is just kind of a what have you done for me lately type list, as these have been the last couple years.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, he's a good player, but he certainly had the benefit of a top offensive line. But in any event, another guy I want to talk about, and maybe you could give the listeners a little bit of a scouting lesson with this guy, Earl Thomas, who a lot of people think is the best safety, and in my opinion, he's the best safety in the NFL. what you like about him and what makes him such a good safety.
Okay. Earl is the engine that drives that legion of boom, in my opinion. And this is, again, just to your point on DeMarco, it's not designed to knock Richard Sherman or Cam Chancellor, whoever the heck the fourth guy has been, but simply to say that they were able to build a defensive system because they had Earl Thomas. That system would not be as effective without him by any stretch of the imagination. And when you are able to bring in a player of that caliber who can make up for the mistakes of other players, they are an aggressive bunch back there, which is great, but aggressive play in football leads more often than not to a higher bust rate in certain situations, right? Just the nature of the beast. You go die for an interception and you don't get it. Now all of a sudden the guy's out and no one's there to tackle him, right? These things just happen. When you have someone back there who's erasing your mistakes, it's a huge advantage. And what it allowed them to do was to go find undervalued assets at corner. No other team was out there in love with Brandon Browner in the CFL at 6'3". And Richard Sherman in the fifth round pick, who had just been converted over, and Byron Maxwell and Jeremy Lane and Walter Thurman and all the rest of them that were able to play. Well, those guys do not provide the athletic profile of Revis. They don't provide the athletic profile of Joe Hayden in his heyday or Patrick Peterson or what have you. But what those players did provide was length and aggressive nature, intelligence, technical proficiency and consistency. And so Seattle was able to go collect a bunch of guys who were fifth round or below picks for no money and put them back there, which gave them a whole bunch of cash and cap money to spend on pass rushers. I mean, how many pass rushers have they just purchased year after year after year to plug in the front? Because they had these cheap but yet effective players in the back end. And again, I don't think that happens if you don't have Earl Thomas, who can play down in the box. He's smart enough to play in the back end. He's got the range. He's got the angles, the discipline, the ball skills, the route recognition, the footwork, the technique. I mean, there's really nothing I can knock about his game, except if he was 6'2 and 210, it'd be even better. I mean, but besides knocking, you know, his size from the way he was born, he brings everything else to the football field that you'd want. So just a pleasure to watch him work.
Absolutely. And I'm just glancing at Twitter, you know, going back to the top 100. So I guess it was confirmed. Aaron Rodgers voted number 2. J.J. Watt voted number 1. So take that for what it's worth, I guess. I mean, you can't go wrong either way.
You're splitting hairs.
Because obviously those two were, you know, neck and neck for the MVP award last season.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a defensive guy. I would have loved to see a defensive guy win it for the first time in a while. If those seasons can't win it, then you'll never see a defensive player ever win it again.
Exactly. I mean,
but the scope of the quarterback position as opposed to the pass rusher position, I love my pass rushers. I was a D-line coach. I love them to death, but quarterback's a tougher position to play. So a guy absolutely that's that proficient at quarterback, it's hard to knock him. Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little biased, too, on defensive line because, I mean, I only played in high school, but I did play offensive and defensive line. So certainly those are two of my favorite positions to watch. So definitely good to see J.J. Watt up there. But, yeah, this has been, you know, quite a show, Dan. And like I said, thanks so much for jumping on. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, though, right now, Dan.
Fair enough.
It's early July. Ian and I are going to start our division preview soon, we've got training camps coming up. But I want you to pick right now who's playing in Super Bowl 50 and who will hoist the historic Lombardi, we'll call it, the 50th Super Bowl title.
Wow. Yeah, you definitely have me on the spot. I have not done my preseason breakdown. So, all right, let's try to – you know, we got to take a little bit of last year's play, a little bit of where the roster's at, any coaching changes. Really liked what Green Bay did last year. I think they're going to be a really strong contender again.
I agree.
I think they added a couple pieces in the back end that help replace the pieces that they lost in free agency, which should keep that engine going. The questions are really about that front seven defensively and who's actually going to be on the field. We've got some suspensions, we've got some injuries and things of that nature. I've a strong affinity for Green Bay right now. So I'll go ahead and pick them. Just, I understand Seattle's very good. We're not going to knock them, but let's go ahead and pick Green Bay for the time
And
being.
Green Bay was 5 minutes away from winning the NFC title at Seattle, so
There you
obviously they're
go.
not unbeatable.
So AFC wise, last year you had the Pats and the Colts in the championship game. I don't necessarily see a repeat of that, but at the same time, who's going to compete? Denver? I don't know. New coaching staff, a lot of change. Could be really good. Could take them a year to get there. Man, that's a hard one to kind of pick through. The AFC does not provide the same number of credible threats, so to speak, to New England. So yeah, gun to my head right now, I'm gonna say Green Bay, New England, and we'll go ahead and say Green Bay pulls it all off.
All right. And one more question, Dan, before I let you go. How fun was it being around Andy Reid? What kind of guy was he?
Big Red. Oh, he's a great guy. Demeanor can vary a little bit. He's definitely got a serious demeanor, that he can bring and that's very credible. When he's in the room and it's time to get shit done, so to speak, you see it and you believe it, you feel it. But when he, kind of lets his hair down, so to speak, and relaxes, and the Hawaiian shirts are an everyday thing. This is not something he just busts out for the Pro Bowl in Hawaii. This is an all day, every
Nice.
day. He really had a family atmosphere with the core group of people. You had to prove yourself, you had to pay your dues, you had to show respect, you had to earn it. But when you did and you were in, he had your back. And that was a great feeling, and a lot of players responded to that. It was hard for a lot of guys to leave Philadelphia. You can go all the way back to Brian Dawkins. It was hard for a lot of guys to leave Philadelphia just because of what you felt in terms of that individual being there for you when you needed him to, and shooting you straight on when you were good and when you were bad and why and all that stuff. And I think that was something that a lot of people, both player wise, front office wise, coaching wise, down to the equipment people. I mean, people were Andy guys and loyal because you knew he had you when you need to.
Yeah, I remember Andy Reid for a while was really the only coach I knew, because I remember the first year I started watching football was the year Andy Reid and Donovan McNabb both came into the league together. So it was just Reid was the only guy I knew, and it was always fun to go see him when they still had training camp down at Lehigh. So definitely good to get a little insight of what kind of guy Reid actually is, and obviously he's still successful in Kansas City.
Absolutely. And will be. And there'll be a few guys from his group there in Kansas City that I think will go on and have head coaching careers themselves.
Right, absolutely. Dan, I want to thank you so much for jumping on our show today. Like I said, unfortunately it was just me. Too bad Ian couldn't join us, but I did what I could to help this train stay on track.
No, it was good to be here. Thank you for your time and the questions, and look forward to seeing stuff around here from you guys and these division previews and whatnot here in the coming weeks.
Absolutely looking forward to it. And anything you want to plug that you're working on, or just where they can find you?
Sure. I mean, you're always more than welcome to come to scoutingacademy.com. Our fall class will be open here soon. We already have a pretty healthy wait list for that. I mean, come join up best you can. We're working on increasing the content we're going to provide there. Have some partnerships around that, and have actually added a partnership with the Senior Bowl from the standpoint of we're going to have a live classroom down there in January
Nice.
that we're going to invite our best students to. We're going to have some behind the scenes access to things like weigh-ins and practice and practice tape, stuff like that, that Phil Savage and his staff are going to allow us into, and really excited about the future there. So yeah, future's bright for the next generation of evaluators.
Awesome. Awesome. Like I said, thanks so much, Dan. Look forward to talking to you soon. Hope to have you back on.
Right.
And like we said, Ian should be back next week, and him and I will start our division previews. It's getting close. Training
Getting
camps
close.
right away, or
Bring
training.
it. Let's go.
That's right. What, 17 days from now until Steelers and Vikings open, so it's going to be a good time. So, again, thanks to Dan, and until next time, come back soon, Ian. We'll see you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody.